From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, will the new auto insurance reform law really save you money?
This is a deal that benefits the insurance companies and is being sold to you by the government, and we don't have a long track record of trusting either one of those entities.
Michigan's dry bean farmers worried the latest Trump tariff threats will hurt their thriving business with their Mexican customers.
Ramping up tariffs through the growing season isn't going to help any of those relationships by any means.
The two Michigan paratroopers who jumped into Normandy 75 years ago on D-Day, including one who had a famous meeting with none other than General Eisenhower.
He had to have been terrified on so many different levels, not only because he's going into combat, but because then General Eisenhower shows up.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, some say Michigan's freshly signed auto insurance reform law will save motorists money. Others argue the opposite. So, which is it?
Depends on who you are.
We'll talk with Eric Lufer of the Citizens Research Council and get an analysis of this new law that's supposed to lower Michigan's high auto insurance rates. That's later in the hour. But first, Michigan's farmers sell a lot of dry beans to Mexico, and they have a lot to be nervous about these days. A 5% tariff on products from Mexico is set to kick in next Monday and could be cranked up as high as 25% by October, unless President Trump satisfied that Mexico is doing more to stop the flow of migrants. Mexican officials are saying they're considering retaliatory tariffs, especially on agricultural products from states that supported the president in 2016. Joe Kramer is executive director of the Michigan Bean Commission. The state's most recent figures show Michigan farmers produced $129 million worth of dry beans in 2017-2018. That's a big crop.
Yes, it is a big crop, and we export about half of the black beans that are in that total to Mexico. So obviously our biggest trading partner outside the U.S., very important market to us, and we've worked for probably three generations at least to build those relationships.
When you say three generations, then there's been a lot of serious ground laying and a lot of work going into developing that Mexican market for Michigan's beans.
There has. 35 years ago, our industry probably started traveling to Mexico, specifically Mexico City, and have developed long-term great relationships with the folks in the import. And we're a little nervous that we've dented or damaged that relationship by not being the preferred supplier that we worked so hard to become. We're very anxious to get this behind us and try to patch the wounds a little bit and move on.
So as these headlines have been unfolding since President Trump tweeted out this threat of punitive tariffs on Mexico, how do you and the farmers you represent feel about all of this?
I think very generally speaking, the farm community has been supportive of President Trump. But the bigger issue of trade is obviously something that they felt needed to be addressed, probably didn't understand or recognize the domino effect that would come back to hit agriculture pretty hard. And I'm closest to the bean industry. I think beans are taking it on the chin, sort of across the board. Obviously, our bean farmers are also corn farmers and wheat farmers and soybean farmers. So they're kind of getting it from all directions, right? China with soybeans and Mexico with corn and dry beans, et cetera.
And Mexican officials have said if U.S. tariffs go into effect, they could add tariffs of their own. And specifically, they mentioned targeting agricultural products from states that supported President Trump. So that would include Michigan. Do you have any sense as you talk to your counterparts on the Mexican side of the border whether Mexico is considering tariffs for Michigan's beans?
The evening that President Trump tweeted about tariffs to Mexico, I had several conversations with several people in Mexico, and I was a little surprised that there was a portion of them that, generally speaking, agreed with the president. They don't believe that their government has done enough to curb the passage of the folks from south of Mexico through Mexico and into the U.S. So while they're not interested in tariffs, they don't want their trade disrupted. The concept that the Mexican government hasn't done enough, they agreed with that. So they were supportive of their government stepping up. They aren't real anxious to be taxed through a tariff on goods coming or going just like we are.
So what would happen? Let's just kind of roll down to the fall. And let's just say the president's not satisfied. And we're looking at, you know, 25% tariffs on Mexico and possibly, you know, retaliatory tariffs on your beans. What happens if Michigan bean farmers lose that market in Mexico?
I think that some of the damage has already been done with the lack of a trade agreement being ratified. I think as we've moved through the NAFTA conversation toward the USMCA conversation, and as that's drug out, our customers south of the border have already began to look at alternative suppliers. So just the conversation alone has our folks looking to Argentina, for example, for black bean. Ramping up tariffs through the growing season isn't going to help any of those relationships by any means. We think we understand the challenge, we being the dry bean growers in the state of Michigan, but at the same time, we don't really want to carry the load on that either of fixing or solving those problems.
A lot of uncertainty for your farmers.
It is, and I think that's the single biggest challenge as farmers work their way through this growing season. We've certainly had weather challenges this spring that only adds pain and agony and frustration to markets that are already depressed, trade negotiations going on in every direction you can imagine, the uncertainty. And I think in the short term, it's caused market depression, but long term, those relationships that we've invested so much time and money in over the years, it's really tough to bring those folks back to you after you've encouraged them to look elsewhere.
I wonder, I'm sure you do too, how long Michigan's dry bean farmers will be feeling the impact of this?
Well, it's already been quite a while, to be honest. I think most of them have prepared as much as possible for this to carry on longer. We were in D.C. last week, and it was encouraging to hear after our departure that the Chinese are interested in sitting back down, because when those trade talks broke down, it seemed as though all trade talks had kind of taken a hit. So it feels like the easy one to get into play today is the USMCA. Get that signed, get it behind us, and then turn our attention to China. That's going to be a long, drawn-out discussion, but we're encouraged this week that the rumors that the Chinese were interested in getting back to the table, and we hope that that's the case, and we hope they can make some good progress there.
Joe Kramer, Executive Director of the Michigan Bean Commission. Joe, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Blending chamber music with public art thanks to the percussion bicycle, and you could pedal it. We'll have that after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, it's Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to talk our state's history. Tomorrow marks 75 years since the largest land and water invasion in history, D-Day. On June 6, 1944, we're going to focus in on two soldiers among the 160,000-some Allied troops part of the D-Day invasion, two Michigan soldiers who served in the 101st Airborne Division, the Screaming Eagles. Rachel Clark of the Michigan History Center is here with us. So, Rachel, who is the first paratrooper we're going to talk about?
The first one we're going to talk about is Staff Sergeant Charles Staub, originally from Detroit, Michigan. He later lives in Birmingham. He was 21 years old when he enlisted and 24 years old on D-Day.
You know, so many of those men who invaded Normandy were kids. Some of them just passed their high school proms when you stop and you think how young they were. So tell me about his service. What did he do in the 101st Airborne?
So he enlisted in 1941, very soon after the United States became involved in the war. And after enlisting, he received training at Chanute Army Airfield in Illinois, and he went to meteorology school. Meteorologists then and today are crucial to any combat mission. And so as D-Day neared, Allied leaders needed those accurate weather reports, and he became a weatherman.
So as a weatherman with the airborne, we have to remember our history, it was the airborne troops, the 82nd and the 101st, they were the ones dropping into Normandy like in the very, very early, early hours of June 6th, if anybody watched Band of Brothers. We saw what that was like. So they were there before the beach landing. So he was a combat weatherman. What was his mission? What was he tasked with doing?
His mission was to drop in ahead of the enemy lines very, very early, as you said, and get as much weather information and intel as he possibly could to report back to Allied leaders that weather intel was going to determine those landings. D-Day was a massive combat mission, both land and air, and these weather reports were absolutely crucial, and they had to be very quick, and they had to be as accurate as possible.
So there they were, dropping behind those enemy lines in the middle of the night, the early, early hours, and things got very, very scattered and confused for those paratroopers. We, again, citing Band of Brothers, you saw what it's like and how scattered everything got. How did things go for Staff Sergeant Staub?
He landed and met up with other regiments, but they were very quickly attacked by German soldiers. So Sergeant Staub was wounded by rifle fire in three spots, and he suffered a concussion from a grenade. He ended up having to kind of hunker down with some of the other Allied soldiers until other Allied troops came to rescue them, essentially.
And how long did that take? How long were they hunkered down and hiding?
It was a few days. It took a little while because they were so far inland. It took time by the time Allied soldiers landed at the beaches and then were able to start marching in. It took a few days, I think between 5 and 7 days, if I remember correctly.
So you stop and you think he had a concussion and he was wounded in three places, and there they were hiding from the Nazis and hoping not to be found until their friendly troops could find them. Was that injury the end of the war for Charles Staub?
It was the end of the war for him, but not his military service. So he served in the weather service and continued in the Air Force and eventually was in the weather service for the Korean War and served with distinction.
And what about the rest of his life then, after he left the military? What do we know?
So he remained in the military until the early to mid-60s. He retired. He married. He had a family. He traveled. He ended up at Bunker Hill Air Force Base, which is now Grissom Air Reserve in Kokomo, Indiana. And then, as I said, he retired in 1963.
And do we know, is he still alive today?
He is not. There are a couple different reports of when he died. The nearest I can see is that he died in Traverse City in 1980, but there's another report that he lived up until 2006.
And we have to underpin this whole conversation with the understanding that we are losing hundreds of our World War II vets every single day. And now we want to focus on a second Michigander, and like Charles Staub, also a member of the 502nd Parachute Infantry Regiment, PIR, of the 101st Airborne. Who are we going to talk about?
This time we're going to talk about Lieutenant Wallace Strobel from Saginaw, Michigan.
And everybody stop and think, one of the most iconic photographs from D-Day is this photo of General Eisenhower meeting with paratroopers before they climbed into those C-47 transport planes to fly to Normandy. And there the troopers are, covered with their black camouflage paint. They've got the helmets on, the gear is strapped on, and Ike is talking to one tall trooper at the center of this photo. I have seen this photo a million times, and you're saying that tall trooper was Wallace Strobel of Michigan?
He is. He's a very young man at that time as well. He was only about 22 years old in that photograph.
How do we know that's him?
There is actually quite a few historic records that go along with that photo, including Strobel's, his own account of that photo being taken. They were in England and preparing for their mission into D-Day. And Eisenhower showed up and he was talking to people, and he had to have been terrified on so many different levels, not only because he's going into combat, but because then, you know, General Eisenhower shows up and
the Supreme Commander is chatting with you.
Yeah, and starts chatting with him. And apparently he asked him where he was from and he said Michigan. And the story is that Eisenhower said, "Good fishing there."
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. So how did the drop go for Lieutenant Strobel?
Let me just give a little bit of background on him. He was Michigan National Guard initially, and then that was federalized to the 32nd Red Arrow. And he volunteered for paratrooper duty and wound up with the 101st. So he dropped behind enemy lines again early that morning of June 6th. And it was a successful mission for him. And he ended up coming out of that alive.
Do we know anything about how the rest of the war went? Because, again, back to Band of Brothers, which was focused on a regiment of the 101st Airborne, that group fought all the way to the end of the war and helped to liberate Hitler's Berchtesgaden. So did Wallace Strobel follow that path through Holland and fighting through France and into Germany?
As far as I can see, yes. He did remain with them, and he came out the other side as unscathed as anybody did.
What did he do after the war?
He returned to Saginaw. He married his high school sweetheart, and he became a successful businessman, and he stayed there.
Is he still with us, or did he pass?
He passed away. He passed away in 1999, and he is buried in Arlington Cemetery with his wife.
What can you tell us, Rachel, about how many Michiganders served in World War II, and do we have a sense of how many never came home?
Michigan's numbers, I don't know how they compare to other states. To me, it looks just enormous. So between non-military and military personnel, you have about 1 million people that contributed to the war effort. We had just over 613,000 military that served. 10,263 died, and nearly 30,000 were wounded. As I said, I don't know what that compares to other states, but those numbers just seem astronomical to me.
It is an incredible effort that the nation came together, and certainly something to remember as we are on the eve of the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. Rachel Clark, Michigan History Center, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take one highly acclaimed quintet of musicians, all virtuosos in their reed instruments, clarinet, bass clarinet, bassoon, oboe, and saxophone. Then add a bicycle tricked out to provide percussion sounds, and this is what you get. That is the sound of the Acropolis Reed Quintet rehearsing a new work by composer Stephen Snowden called Sprocket. It's being premiered this week. And here with us is the director and the saxophonist for the Acropolis Reed Quintet. So good to have you here. And a percussion bicycle?
Indeed. Yeah. So the percussion bicycle is built by Juan Martinez, who is a metal artist who lives in Detroit. He is a Kresge Arts Fellow, which means he's really good.
Yes. And acclaimed.
yes. Just as Acropolis is. Thank you for that. And so he designs bicycles that live among us and which move and articulate different animals and different things when you ride them. So we thought in collaborating, we wanted to collaborate with someone in Detroit who wasn't a musical artist. How could we do something that was a little bit outside the box? So how about combine the work that he does with musical work, create a bicycle, but create it such that when pedaled, it's crafted such that the pedaling makes different noises. So there's an accordion on the bike that opens and closes, and the music, you can hear that a little bit. And then a car spring, an actual shock spring from a car. That was in one of the little clips that we heard as well, and some other beautiful percussion instruments. And then it's all put together by a composer who is neither Juan or Acropolis.
Yes.
Stephen Snowden, a wonderful composer from Boston. He grew up in Missouri, but he lives in Boston now. He had kind of been very high on our wish list of composers, but he was just the perfect person for this project. His name kept coming up, and then finally this is the one for him.
And why was he the perfect person? Why did his name come up?
Yeah, so Stephen writes often for percussion. He also writes for, he had written for winds and stuff. His music had been described by a pretty big paper somewhere, I can't remember which one, as a red-blooded and rustic. And so he just has this certain way of writing that just seemed to really jive with the kind of aesthetic of this piece, with this sort of janky bicycle vibe and all that kind of stuff.
Is the percussionist riding the bicycle as you're performing this music? How's it done?
So during the piece, the bicycle stays still,
okay. But
it can be pedaled with the kickstand. So it's pedaled during the piece, but it just doesn't move around. But the bicycle can be ridden around, and then you can play the accordion while you're riding it. And so people are going to get to do that on this Saturday at the De Quinder Cut.
When you premiere the piece.
Yes.
So people can get on and try this. So this is really, it's music, but it's also an art installation, isn't it?
That's right. It's really kind of difficult to categorize everything that's going on here, right? It's chamber music, it's classical music, it's contemporary, it's public art, it's a sculpture at the same time, all these different kinds of things. So when it's all over, someone will write something about it, and we'll figure out what to call it. I don't know.
and this is kind of an effort to engage the bike community with this work, including premiering it at the De Quinder Cut. Talk about that a little.
Yeah, sure. Well, this is all part of Together We Sound, which is a festival that Acropolis puts on for 2 weeks. And the entire purpose of Together We Sound is to bring this chamber music and new chamber music to people that just wouldn't usually get to experience it. So this year, with this kind of project, we were able to do that and bring it to people who are in the cycling community or in the bike community, people who happen to be on the bike path, people who maybe wouldn't come out to see a chamber music concert, maybe they wouldn't come out to see any kind of new classical music, but because they just are really struck by this unique installation and everything, they want to come out and do it. So not necessarily bikers or cyclists, sure, but that would be one place. And we do have a lot of promotional partners for all the events that have been bike shops, have been getting into it and stuff like that. So,
and I know the five of you met at the University of Michigan. How far back does your love of music go?
Oh, me? Well, probably before I was born. I know my parents were just, it was a lot of singer-songwriter sound, you know, blaring in the house,
such
lot of 70s
as
horn rock,
oh,
a lot of Carly Simon, a lot of
Chicago.
Yeah, a lot of Chicago. Tower Power, I'm sort of a Tower Power snob, but and then I started piano when I was five, and then saxophone and clarinet in middle school, and saxophone just seemed to be the best for me, so I stuck with it.
I know Acropolis has a new album out called The Space Between Us. Let's check out a track called Gallimaufry. Do you worry about where future instrumental players are going to come from? Because we see schools being forced, reluctantly in many cases, to trim their music offerings.
Yeah, I guess I do worry about it a little bit. Acropolis does quite a lot of work. We work with three high schools in Detroit where they compose music for us. We have a residency. And we do a lot of elementary school presentations, a lot, 50 or so probably every year all around the country, where we introduce students to music. And a lot of people have us out to do that stuff because they're also worried, I guess. But at the same time, we found music to just be so universal. I mean, a child... no matter how the world changes, when you're 5 or 6 years old and you see and you hear live music on a musical instrument for the first time, it doesn't matter how electrified the world gets. It really doesn't. At that age, that is the best thing to you.
Yeah.
So I guess I could say I'm a little worried, but I also know that as long as we stick with it and we keep promoting it and all that stuff, I think we'll be okay.
Lots of fun. Well, you can learn more about the Together We Sound Festival, more about Sprocket. Just go to the Acropolis website. And remember, that's Acropolis spelled with a K, acropolisquintet.org. And we've been talking with its director, saxophonist Matt Landry. What a pleasure. Thank you for sharing your passion with us.
Thank you for having me.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Michigan's internationally acclaimed poet and essayist Thomas Lynch is best known for his writings on death. Lynch is out with a new collection of essays and poetry. It's titled Whence and Whither on Lives and Living. Our reviewer Keith Taylor talks about the importance of this collection.
For several decades, Thomas Lynch worked as the funeral director in Milford, Michigan. It was work that brought him into contact with his townspeople at their most vulnerable moments. He learned much from these people about fear and faith, about love, and about the places where love was not quite enough. There was another occupation that kept Lynch up at night, working alone in the front room of the old house across the street from the funeral home. There he wrote poems and practiced his prose. It appears that he fits the stereotype and had the Irish gift of words, how they sounded off each other and where they released their meaning. He started winning awards for his poetry and his essays. Over the years, he published 10 books, essays, poetry, even a collection of short stories. He contributed to the popular, professional, and literary press. In Britain, he has been a respected commentator on the BBC. Now, in this new book, Whence and Whither, he has collected many of these pieces. But the book doesn't feel random. It has direction and purpose. Lynch memorializes Irish and American poets he's been close to over the years. Perhaps the most moving of these is about the great Irish Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney. Lynch rode with the undertaker in the hearse that carried Heaney's body from Dublin to Derry for burial. Lynch writes, "All the way up there, people lined the way, on the overpasses and in the halted intersections where people got out of their cars to applaud the cortege of the great poet. Women were weeping and wiping tears from their faces. Men held the palms of their hands to their hearts, caps doffed, thumbs up, everyone at their best attention. Maybe Ireland is the only place left where poets are loved this much. But the theme that unifies most of this book is Lynch's attempt to understand his own faith, or his lack of it. He calls himself happily apostate, and like many adult Catholics, he's felt betrayed by the hierarchic response to the abuse accusations these last few years. Yet in his occupation, he has been confronted daily with a courage he associates with religious figures. He writes about funerals. When someone shows up, priest or pastor, rabbi or imam, venerable master or fellow traveler, to stand with the living and the dead, armed with nothing more than a shred of faith and helpful purpose, I know I am witnessing uncommon courage, and my perpetually shaken faith is emboldened by theirs. There are no easy answers in whence and whither, nothing that resolves the big questions, from whence do we come and whither do we go. But there is the moving story of one man's search through his own mind, and his occupation, and his perpetually shaken faith.
That was writer Keith Taylor with his review of writer Thomas Lynch's latest collection, Whence and Whither, on Lives and Living. Still to come, with this warm weather, out come the bicycles. But just how bike-friendly is our state? We'll talk about that and why it matters. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Can you bike safely where you live? Do you worry about cars passing too closely? Are there enough dedicated lanes and paths? With cyclists out in full force during the summer, we asked avid riders around the state just how bike-friendly the roads are where they live.
My name is Paul Guthrie, and I live in Portage, Michigan. So I think Kalamazoo is becoming ever more friendly since the dark mark in our bicycling history, which was the 2016 tragedy that killed five cyclists with a drugged driver. Some things that can help a lot for wherever you're cycling is cutting down and cracking down on distracted driving. That's dangerous to everyone, especially bicyclists, because they're so much more vulnerable on the road than a car, as well as enforcing speed limit. When you're going 55 miles an hour, you're going about 80 feet per second. Speed kills.
My name is Shelley Spivak, and I'm from Flint. I think Flint is becoming a very bike-friendly city. I think what could make this city more bike-friendly would be for additional monies to be allocated for additional bike lanes and bike trails, for different organizations to make cycling more available to youngsters who don't have the ability to purchase bikes.
My name is Rhonda Solomon, and I'm from Grand Rapids, Michigan. The level of bike friendliness on Grand Rapids has improved substantially. I would probably bike to work a lot more, though I find that it's not the distance that really typically would prohibit me from doing that, but rather whether or not I have a bike-friendly lane or whether or not I feel like there is any safety issues that would be involved in that.
My name is Nate Phipps, and I'm from Ann Arbor. I think Ann Arbor needs to pick up the pace of protected bicycle lanes and other forms of more protected infrastructure, as well as making sure that roads are widened, that there's bike lanes, that cyclists feel encouraged and welcome to use the roads, as well as making it loud and clear to other road users that cyclists sort of belong out on the roads and are actually part of a vital, healthy city.
Here to talk bike friendliness in Michigan is John Lindenmayer, Executive Director of the League of Michigan Bicyclists. John, just what does it mean for a state to be bike friendly? What does that look like?
Well, it's when a state and the communities at the local level embrace a number of things. So there's a national bicycle-friendly communities program put out by our counterparts at the League of American Bicyclists. And they actually do a ranking of communities and states all around the country. And Michigan actually has 12 bicycle-friendly communities in the state. They rank them from bronze on up to platinum. And we have 4 silver communities and 8 bronze. And they do that ranking on what we call the 5 E's. That's engineering, education, encouragement, enforcement, and evaluation. So with engineering, they're creating safe and convenient places for people to ride in the community. On the education front, they're giving people of all ages and abilities the skills and confidence to ride. And encouragement, they're creating strong bike culture. And I think that's a really big one that welcomes and celebrates bicycling. And enforcement, the law enforcement play a really key role in ensuring that our roads are safe for all users and enforcing traffic laws like safe passing for bicyclists and speeding. And then evaluation, at the end of the day, we have to make sure it's working. So planning for bicycling as a safe and viable transportation option, making sure that's incorporated into our planning process.
And the latest report card from this parent organization looking into who is bicycle friendly puts Michigan at number 13 of the 50 states in being bicycle friendly and finds Michigan tends to do better in categories where the State Department of Transportation has control over the components in the categories. Can you talk more about that? Why is this?
Yeah, so we're currently ranked 13th. I try not to take too much stock in national surveys and polls, but we have improved from a year or two back where we were 18th. So we are making some strides in our state. This last year, we saw some significant improvements in state law with a safe passing law, with incorporating an hour within our driver's education curriculum to make sure at an early age we're educating young drivers how to safely interact with bicyclists. And to get to your question about local and county road agencies versus the state, I think a big part of that has to do with the engineering and the infrastructure. So Michigan, at the statewide level, we have a complete streets law that was passed a number of years ago, and it requires that the state roads, when they do major road work, that they look at how they accommodate all users. And that includes bicyclists, pedestrians, people with disabilities, transit users. And so it's completing the streets and making sure that they're safe and convenient no matter what mode of transportation people are making. So MDOT's doing a good job of making those investments on the roads that they control to put in safer facilities. That includes bike lanes, protected bike lanes, sidewalks, crosswalks, your common bicycle and pedestrian non-motorized infrastructure.
I know over the weekend we heard news that a 61-year-old woman bicyclist was killed in a hit-and-run crash. It happened along the I-96 service drive on Detroit's west side. It happened at night. And I know I saw in this report that Michigan is the seventh highest rate of bicyclist fatalities per capita. And I know your group is pushing the state to crack down on distracted driving. How much of all of that is, in your view, due to distracted driving?
I think a significant portion. So we saw a spike in bicycle and pedestrian fatalities the last couple of years. We're happy that they have gone down. But tragedies like this do remind us that we have a lot of work to do. And that is the number one reason that we're hearing why people aren't bicycling more, why they're choosing not to bicycle anymore. They're afraid of the distracted driver on the road who's messing around with their phone while they're driving. And we all see it every day, whether we're biking or see it from another driver going by. There's just too much focus being taken away from the road because of these devices in our hands. And so we're asking folks, two eyes on the road, two hands on the wheel, and when you're driving, just drive. As a bicyclist or a pedestrian for that matter, we're inherently vulnerable out there on the road because we don't have those seatbelts and airbags and other safety protections that might save your life. So everybody's at risk from distracted driving, but bicyclists and pedestrians are especially at risk. And we know that there's more of these crashes happening than actually get reported because it's really difficult to enforce. And so that's why we're pushing through the Michigan legislature right now a hands-free law. And that's what we're asking for. That'll make it easy for law enforcement to pull over a driver if they see somebody with a phone in their hands.
I just wonder how much bad or dangerous behavior that you describe by drivers that I agree with you. I see it every single day as I drive back and forth to work, people thumbing away on their phones while they're driving on the freeway. And it's this addiction to smartphones. And I'm wondering, is it really beyond legislation?
Well, it can't be. It just simply can't be. There are 18 other states who have passed the hands-free law. And in the states that have these new laws over the past couple of years, they're seeing a reduction in these traffic fatalities caused by distracted driving. We know our texting while driving law in Michigan is weak and has a lot of loopholes. And Michigan law enforcement, that's what they're asking for. They want a hands-free law that will give them the ability to pull somebody over without having to get a warrant to make that traffic stop and crack down on this. So we know with education and enforcement, Yes, we're all addicted to our phones, but we need to create change. And just like we did with seatbelts, just like we've done with drunk driving, it has to be socially unacceptable to be driving around with a phone in our hand. And that's when I think we create culture change and create that shift, and we see the results and the injuries and fatalities going down because of it.
John, why does it matter to be a bike-friendly city, a bike-friendly state? Why does biking matter?
I mean, there's so many reasons that biking is great. So besides just being great social activity and a fun way to spend time with family, with friends, bicycling can really be a simple, common sense solution to a lot of really complex problems we're facing as a state, as a society. So on the personal health and wellness side, creating communities that support cycling, you know, help combat obesity. And when you create those safe and convenient places for people to bike and to commute to work and school, they incorporate exercise into their daily routines. We know we have issues with the environment and climate change. So when you swap out calories for carbon, that can create a lot of significant changes for the environment. We know that 60% of our trips are a mile or less, but very few of those are taken by bike. So again, if you build it, they'll come. If you make it safe and convenient, people will bike those trips and transfer those out of vehicles. And then we also, in Michigan, it's a huge part of our economy and tourism. Bicycling actually generates $686 million a year for our state, according to a recent study by the Department of Transportation. So there's all these opportunities and wonderful things that bicycling can do for our state and our community if we embrace it.
John Lindemeyer, Executive Director of the League of Michigan Bicyclists. John, thanks for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
That auto insurance reform law signed with a flourish by Governor Whitmer last week has not exactly settled questions and debate about whether we're going to see premiums go down. Supporters say many drivers could save thousands every year. Critics disagree. Let's see if Eric Lufer can help shed light on this. He's with the nonpartisan think tank, the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. Eric, let's cut right to the chase. Do you think car insurance rates will go down because of this new law?
Yeah, there is a lot of reason to think that it will. Will it for everyone? I don't know. But we spent a lot of time looking at the health insurance side of the law and the changes that were made through the bill that was signed last week do a lot to rein in those costs and provide customers choice, which allows them to find a product that suits them. It's an insurance program, so in choosing lower cost, you might be putting yourself at risk, but the end result is you should save money. So, yeah, I think there's a real opportunity to save money with the bill that was signed.
Why are some arguing, then, that many Michiganders will still see their car insurance rates increase under this new law? Why are we hearing that?
Well, first of all, this is a deal that benefits the insurance companies and is being sold to you by the government, and we don't have a long track record of trusting either one of those entities. But if we do, then we look at how the changes are being made. A lot of changes are made to reduce the cost of insuring in our inner cities, Detroit and Pontiac and Flint and so on. So if you're going to rein in those costs, but it still costs money for the insurers to make sure all of us are going to be protected, those costs have to be shifted somewhere. And I think that creates some level of uncertainty. The bill is so new. There was so little time between when it was introduced, when it was voted on, when it was signed into law, that there hasn't been a lot of time to digest it. But just looking at sort of doing the math in your head, I think it creates some suspicion that some are going to win and some are going to lose. But you know, we just don't know yet. It's so new.
So it's so new. We're not even sure yet who will win and who will lose. Is that what I think I hear you say?
Yeah, I think that's it. The insurance companies haven't had time to digest it, so they can't feed us information on how they're going to make changes and who's going to be affected by it.
Yeah, there has been a lot written, a lot said, expressing concern for people who've been injured in car crashes, people who've been getting those unlimited medical and care benefits. What does this new law hold for those people?
So one of the major aspects of this law is to control the cost when you're in an auto accident. The way the old law was written, the insurers had to pay the amount that was charged. And when you ever get a statement from your insurance company, it would say, the hospital, the doctor, the x-ray technician charge this much, but we have told them we would pay that much. But the auto insurers always have to pay that first amount. So they did some changes in the law that will change that, allow for a lesser amount to be charged. And so that's going to affect the healthcare providers, right? This is how they were making a living with what they were doing. For hospitals and primary care physician, it will cost, you know, they'll have to do some evening out and try to figure out how to make things work. But there's a lot of healthcare providers for those people that were seriously injured, those that benefited from this lifetime benefit aspect of what we had. And so this closed head injuries, the spinal injuries, there's places, clinics that exist to serve those people. And if those costs are going to be reduced in major ways, there's a question of whether they'll be around to serve people that have already been injured and people that will be injured in the future. Will they get the care that they need in the specialized way that we've been able to do in Michigan that many states don't have that because of the different insurance programs?
So we're not sure at this point what this may hold, especially if someone's been relying on a particular, let's say, closed head injury treatment center that may not be able to stay open.
That's exactly the point, yes.
Yeah, and then you did comment on the how quickly this bill moved through the legislature with that one-hour public hearing and then zipping off to get signed by the governor during the Mackinac Policy Conference. And the Detroit News is telling us lawmakers already had to make one fix to this law, this reform law, because if they didn't fix it, there would have been a spike in the price of auto insurance.
You know, that's the price we pay for doing something so quick. Government is meant to work slowly to have eyes on proposals and get input and see how different people are affected. And I don't think anybody is served under any circumstance when things are rushed through the way that this was. It's nothing against this one. It is, in general, we intend government to work slow and to be a mediator between the different interests of society. Yes, we've been talking about no-fault reform for many, many years, and the proposals were out there. But you have drafters putting this together overnight. They're tired. They want to get home to their kids. Mistakes are made, and if you don't have time to read through it and ask questions, then this is the result you get, and there'll be many other cleanups beside the one that they had to do yesterday.
You know, this new law, as you commented earlier, bans insurers from using this whole big range of non-driving factors in setting rates. So gender and education level, marital status, whether or not you own a home, your occupation, credit scores, zip codes. And it's being looked at as one of the broadest, and if you're an insurer, one of the toughest non-driving factor bans in the country. Do you feel it will make a substantial difference in what we pay?
Depends on who you are.
Uh-huh.
If you're one of those people that were negatively affected by those means of scoring, then yes, you should benefit from it. You know, I'm a white male, middle-aged, and I probably I benefited from it. How I'm going to be affected in the future remains to be seen.
You know, there is so much finger-pointing and you know, opposing claims being batted back and forth by supporters and detractors since this bill was signed into law. So how can people who want to make the best decisions know whom to believe?
That's a good question. You know, it took so long to get something done because this was an issue that really was a zero-sum game. You had healthcare providers on one side and insurers on the other. We often lost track of the fact that there are people at the end of this, people that are harmed because of auto accidents and need the care going forward. So, you know, who's out there to trust? Well, I think there's media members. The fact that you're doing this and the Detroit News and others are trying to get information to the people going forward. The state has a financial insurance bureau that's meant to get information out, and a part of the law is to try to use that conduit, use their website to do more to distribute information. You know, I don't know. I wish I had a better answer for you.
I'm sure a lot of Michiganders do as well, Eric. I think there is certainly safe to say that no one really knows how this reform law is going to play out.
Yeah, that's the tough part right now, is it's so new and it's going to take a while for the dust to settle and we can figure out where we are and where we're going.
Eric Lufer, Citizens Research Council of Michigan. Eric, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
For decades, Flint kids would gather at the Donald R. Cronin Derby Downs and take their shot at winning the city's Soapbox Derby race. And now for the first time in 25 years, Flint will host an official Soapbox Derby competition and perhaps even produce another world champion. That's tomorrow on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.